Welcome to Lit with Charles, a podcast on all things literary where I interview people who've either written books or have interesting things to say about them. If you're like me, then you love reading, but maybe you're not sure what you should be reading, or maybe you feel intimidated by conversations around books. The main aim of this podcast is to make literature exciting and accessible, and hopefully make you discover new books and authors that are off the beaten track. In this podcast, I try to cover all genres and types of books, from serious historical nonfiction to trashy novels, and I talk to all sorts of authors so that it never feels like the same episode twice.
Obviously, this book does push boundaries, and that is primarily thanks to Weatherglass, my publishers, who kept pushing me. Even it got to points where I was like, I don't want to push her anymore. But because, yeah, as a writer, it's these were realms where, you know, in my head, it's there. And to actually put that down on the page and actually start to make that happen is quite frightening.
One of the best propulsive forces in literature, the force that keeps me turning pages as I read a novel, is the question, where on earth is this going? And that question kept coming back to me as I read a very exciting debut novel called How to Be a French Girl by Rose Cleary, who's a young British writer. In the book, a 20-something young girl who's given up on a promising art education starts to work a boring temp job in London in order to survive. And she commutes there every morning from Essex, and eventually she develops an unhealthy obsession in an elegant French colleague called Gustave. You'll hear that name a lot during the interview. Inspired by tropes about French girls driven by our technological world, she tries to transform herself into the titular and idealized French girl. Her romantic pursuit and evolution as a character twists and turns in ways that are increasingly uncomfortable and unpredictable, but potentially may be justified. Overall, this novel felt to me like the secret love child of Bridget Jones and Fatal Attraction, with a touch of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Anyway, this is a fun book. It went places that were genuinely surprising, uncomfortable, and disturbing, and I really recommend it. I love to have new authors onto the show to help with the visibility of their work. It's always exciting to talk to a new young author. In this episode, Rose Cleary and I go through some of the themes featured in the book, like power, identity, technology, art, class, and all the other themes that populate this great novel. This is your first novel. What was the path to writing it? What were some of the ideas behind it that inspired you?
So I didn't really set out to write a novel. I feel that I potentially always had a novel in me. I was just always one of those kids who used to write and read a lot. But when it came to actually sitting down and starting it, at the time I was processing a lot of things I was going through at that point in time. So I was working a kind of dead-end job. I was commuting into London from Southend, which for people who aren't aware, it's a fairly straightforward journey, but commuting into city is a whole kind of realm within itself. And I was quite interested in that, how it was kind of this very monotonous and kind of all-consuming rite of passage that one has to take to get into the city to work. So I was kind of processing that, and the novel started as, well, I used to write poetry, so it kind of started as a more sort of collection of poems around that. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So you went from a poetic form to a novel. At what moment did you realize that you wanted to shift from one to the other?
I started to break it down and sort of, you know, while I was putting this collection of poems together, I started to ruminate a bit more on the commute itself and the scenery, and started to build up a sort of narrative around that. So that's when it shifted from poetry more to sort of prose or fiction work. And I think at that point I realized, you know, as the sort of it progressed, and I realized what I actually wanted to write about, which is not radically different, but very different to how it started the novel. That was when it was okay. I realized that in order for me to be able to tell this kind of story, I need to make that switch. And this is now going to become a novel, so to speak. So It was quite an organic process, but I think just in terms of being able to actually tell the story, it was necessary for it to be a novel.
I mean, the major difference between, say, poetry and prose and a novel would be essentially a plot. And so I'm assuming that you had the atmospherics of the commute and the dead-end job. But what I really enjoyed in your book was also where the story went and how it navigated these different worlds. And it was very powerfully thrust forward, I thought. And so did that require an entirely new, different amount of work to build that plot and the characters that drive the plot?
Yeah, it was a strange one because I kind of started it with an idea in mind of the story I wanted to tell. But the story I wanted to tell, which was a bit more sort of potentially more sort of novella-like, it was more about someone who is stuck on the commute and then that's it. But obviously, as I was processing the things that were happening to me at the time, I was linking in a lot of the relationships I was happening with this kind of neoliberal landscape in a sense and finding everything sort of very artificial. And I was quite interested in exploring how these things were sort of all on the same kind of surface. There is a real sort of propulsion, I would say, which I didn't really pick up whilst kind of putting this narrative together, but my publishers and readers have since said it kind of reads sort of thriller-like because it's quite fast. I guess a lot of that drive came from just the excitement of where things were going. Obviously, the protagonist's relationship with this older, more mature French man is kind of an exciting thing to explore, and particularly that sort of, you know, her fantasies and where these fantasies push her towards. That was kind of the central driving force, really, but that kind of evolved. I still feel the themes that I was trying to explore originally compared with how the novel is now are kind of the same, but obviously it's more to do with sort of female agency and obsession itself, wanting an embodied experience too. So, but yeah, her obsession with the older French man was, that became the central drive for the novel.
I mean, it's not all about plot. I thought that you had an amazing exploration of different themes like identity and power, and you talk about obsession. I looked at it almost as sort of a denial of reality, almost, in which she plunges further and further. And that's almost aided and abetted by this very technological world in which we live, where everything is Googled, everybody meets on Tinder, you know, and so on. How do all these themes, let's say identity, power, reality, technology, how do they all connect to your personal experiences? Did you set out to add that layer of technology, which I thought was really very astute and well put together?
Thank you. I mean, it's probably fairly clear from the novel that I have experience of dating apps and Microsoft Outlook and all these kind of things. And I think in a general sense, that is kind of the way forward. Like, I know we kind of talk about, or certainly, you know, with the use of sort of dating apps and technology and the similar way that I've used it in fiction and media like that, it tends to be sort of, this is, you know, very of our time. Could this become outdated? But I really don't see there being another way forward from that. Or potentially, you know, things are only going to escalate. I'm not trying to go Black Mirror, but I feel like, you know, dating apps have been here for a while. So it's not really that new of a thing. And I was a bit concerned at the time that my novel would actually be outdated because of that. But I guess that's the point, is that I wanted it to be mundane, like that use, the dating apps, the emails, the checking off her phone, things like that. And particularly within the first act of the novel, I wanted it to be as boring as possible, because then that made a lot more sense for her to kind of escape that. And for the reader as well, that monotony was intentional. But I think in terms of the themes, like with the dating apps and things like that, the protagonist is a very superficial person, but she is kind of trapped by that superficiality. And so she's internalized a lot of these, you know, particularly oppressions around misogyny, classism as well. She judges people, but also expects to be judged kind of by the same lens. So I think she's just kind of trapped in these sort of, you know, superficial things like office work, casual wear, or office wear, dating apps, Outlook, and she wants to be free of that and live a sort of embodied, wonderful existence. But at the same time, she uses these things to protect herself.
But in a way, it sort of warps her reality, it seems, a little bit. And I felt that her connections to others were completely warped by, you know, she thinks of someone and instantly Googles them or goes to the LinkedIn profile and assesses them according to their LinkedIn imagery. And oh, it's the standard picture you would imagine from that kind of thing. And she seemed to inhabit a world where everything was quite disembodied almost. There's green trousers in the office. The marketing person doesn't even have a name. It's just marketing, which I thought was very clever and fun. Do you think technology warps reality to a certain extent for people?
Yes, because it does seep into our reality, but also think it is a kind of a different reality. It's a tricky one to say. Like, I had this conversation at the launch of the book about, you know, how she kind of uses Google Maps to seek out what she does. In a sense, I don't think what she does, you know, and it might not be normal, but what she does in terms of, oh, who's that person? I'm going to Google them. I can find out where they are on social media. I can kind of find out where they live and where they work. In their essence, they're kind of permitted because this information is so easy to find online. And just Googling random people that you find and checking out their LinkedIn, I think almost everyone does that.
Absolutely. And I'd be the first one to admit it. But I think what was interesting is how you pushed it to a place where it almost became unhealthy.
Yeah. And I think that's a central difference with her is that, yeah, she is kind of relatable in a sense. But in terms of, you know, finding out where people work and where they live, she will actually go to the place in physical reality as well. Mm. And I think that's a big key difference is that she has this real insular world, which technology is kind of like, a really weird metaphor has come to my head. I don't know if metaphor is the right turn of phrase, but she's sort of like on a sleigh being led by reindeer, and the reindeer is technology, and she is using the technology to get to where she needs to be. But the conversation I had at my launch was that in terms of her using Google Maps to get about, I can't really go on holiday without Google Maps. I've had some really weird journeys and adventures where I couldn't go out of it without Google Maps. So I think, yes, these tools are really good and helpful, but they have fundamentally changed the way that we interact with the world. And like you say, she is completely disembodied. And I think the fact that, you know, her use of technology also gets her the results that she wants means she kind of gets really disconnected from what is actually happening around that.
I mean, I don't want our listeners to think that this book is only about technology and the relationship to it. That's one angle of it. Another angle of the book that I really liked was its discussion around art. It is one of the central focuses of the book. And in that sense, the narrator constantly pushes boundaries in ways that are sometimes small and sometimes big in a frightening way. Is pushing boundaries part of being an artist for you?
So for me, another little autobiographical detail that went in was obviously I experienced art school. I think my relationship to art school compared to the Pragnus was different. But a lot of those kind of frustrations about what it does to you as a creative have certainly come out there.
So you were sort of taking a revenge on art school in a way? Is that?
No, I think I was kind of taking a step back and thinking, like, I had some conversations with people who went to the Slade, which is where our protagonist went. And my experience of art school has really greatly shaped how I move forwards talking about art and the art world. And then I spoke to someone who is a practicing artist and who goes to the Slade, and his attitude was, well, yeah, you know, it's the Slade, also, you know, we all had a good time, you kind of blah, 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 got on. So that made me reflect upon, okay, so how the protagonist is experiencing it. Obviously, she, you know, there are social ecological conditions which she is existing in, but she also has her own perception of that. And in her character, she doesn't have the wherewithal or assertiveness to kind of be constructive about it. I'm not saying people should put up with socioeconomic oppressions, but there are things she can do with what she's got and she just doesn't. And just going back to your original question, I think obviously this book does push boundaries, and that is primarily thanks to Weatherglass, my publishers, who we worked together for a really long time, kind of, you know, fixing the novel up and kind of redeveloping the narrative. And they kept pushing me. Even it got to points where I was like, I don't want to push her anymore. But the point is that, because, yeah, as a writer, it's these were realms where, you know, in my head, it's there. And to actually put that down on the page and actually start to make that happen is quite frightening.
I mean, there were bits in your book where I had to put it down.
Really?
Where I couldn't keep reading. Like, it's so uncomfortable. And, but she pushes it and she keeps pushing and almost with no fear, but that's, I don't know, is driven by a sort of, yeah, detachment from reality. But at the same time, you sort of thought, well, her behavior may in fact be justified in a lot of ways, that this guy that she has an attachment to did misbehave. And, you know, she maybe does deserve a better explanation or outcome. So it was interesting. You said your publisher pushed you in that direction, because I thought it was very effective and, yeah, very uncomfortable at times.
Thank you. But you've made a really good point, is that it links me to something I read in one of the reviews of the book. Obviously, there's Javier, who's the Colombian guy who's obviously really interested in the protagonist, but she potentially uses him. Again, I don't want to put, I think there's a lot of, like you say, a lot of scenarios where there could be a label put on that in terms of, you know, power dynamic, but I think that's kind of open to interpretation. But he does fairly similar things in that he shows up at her work, offers to, you know, do things for her, kind of messages her, contacts her despite her non-interest. And I don't see Javier as a threatening person at all. I feel, you know, quite sorry for him generally, but it was interesting to kind of see that, because I hadn't realized there was that kind of, I guess, foreshadowing in that respect, or a kind of symmetry to it, not foreshadowing. And then when it comes to, obviously, there's what happens with Gustave, the older French man in the office. And obviously, I don't want to spoil it, but in terms of how she tries to spin that to her advantage, I had some qualms about that. And I think it's because I went to, you know, obviously as a woman and considering what that experience is like, I had some real qualms about that scene. At one point, I did just take it out because I thought, I can't, you know, how are people going to read that? Are they going to read that as, you know, women who make allegations about sexual harassment? How am I telling that? But Weatherglass were like, or my editors at Weatherglass were like, well, but that is true though. You know, what she is alleging did actually happen. So I think overall, the kind of, and what it kind of comes down to the conclusion is that she's not ever really in power. Like, she's kind of obviously obsessive and she can be quite aggressive at times and very persistent, but she's sort of ultimately fairly regressive in a sense. You know, she's kind of advancing towards something, but ultimately what she wants is to submit, particularly to Gustave. So that was the kind of central thing in the middle of that, I guess, that it does make people quite uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the ambiguity is where the discomfort is. It was really interesting to see how it was developing. And so I kept asking myself, where is this going? Which I think is one of the best questions a reader can ask. Like, what is happening here? Where is this going? Not just from a plot device, but also from a thematic point of view. I thought it was really cool that it's like, oh, is this a book about technology, or is this a book about sexual harassment, or is this a book about art, and ultimately where does it end? And I don't want to spoil it for the readers what the sort of final outcome is and where I think it lands from a theme point of view. But so it was zigzagging so much in a good way. How much of that was planned in terms of the story twisting and turning, the themes twisting and turning, or was it not planned and you were just sort of writing as you went and thinking, oh, this is a cool outcome. I'm going to go in this direction now. And then how much of it was structured and planned?
So, yeah, to be honest, my writing is fairly instinctive. Obviously, there were kind of things in mind starting it, and those are things which kind of carried through or developed a little bit more. In a general sense, I have an idea of where I want things to go, and then I will just keep writing until it gets to that point. And then some things come along accidentally, or sometimes it's worth going back, or just getting rid of it all completely. So it was primarily accidental. I think the main point was that I knew, in terms of the Gustave situation, that she, I don't know if this is spoiling it, but she wasn't going to win the situation. I also knew she wasn't going to get better. So in terms of her, you know, her use of technology subsides a little bit, but that's, although one thing I guess is that when it comes to Gustave, obviously through the central act, she does have that chance to feel kind of embodied because she's in pain, you know, faced with that sort of rejection and the connections that she makes with his daughter as well becomes a sort of a real thing for her. So in that respect, she does change, but there is still that kind of tilt shift towards the end where it's she's going in one direction. So that was always kind of it.
I see. Yeah. Because I sort of imagined, again, a whole host of possibilities for where it was going. And you know, they don't end up together, or they end up together, or she ends up with someone else who's a character, or she doesn't, or it all ends very badly for her, or it ends super well for her. I just couldn't really figure out. But the end was consistent with the whole development. So it's not like you sprung a crazy twist out of nowhere. It advanced in a very good way. With regard to the art, I want to come back to that subject a little bit, because I think that the creation of art in literature and how it relates, I find those subjects very interesting. And at one point, the narrator remembers her education at the Slade, and she remembers that a teacher says that art should have a quote-unquote objective. Do you agree with that with regard to art? And if you do, what was your quote-unquote objective with this book?
I don't agree, but I think in terms of how that tends to go sort of within art school, there's this thing called like crits or critiques where, you know, whatever you're working on, everybody goes round and you present your work to the whole class, and then it's their chance to just say, you know, it's kind of a situation I described in the book. And then everyone just says what they think of it. It's a chance for them to say whatever they want within reason. But, and obviously your tutor kind of guides that. But that can be a real sort of flaying of the skin experience. And I think that's potentially something I've struggled with, and what I wanted to put in is that, you know, you're kind of making things very organically, but then you have to explain what you're doing, and that sometimes leads people to make explanations which are false, or, you know, just the kind of the academization, if that's how you pronounce it, of art school is the issue there, which I don't necessarily agree with. And with this book, there really wasn't, I absolutely didn't set out to write anything thriller-like, we can say for sure. Primarily, I knew that it was quite a sad book, probably quite funny in places and gradually getting more and more dark as things go on. But I guess that's one beautiful, one beautiful thing about the book is that it was a very organic process, and it was very led by these kind of desires the protagonist has and how these things all kind of explode in her face, I would say. Or ultimately, I would say, it's, I don't know how you feel about the conclusion, but thematically, I think it ties in really well to, in a sense, it is a complete kind of submission when it comes to art specifically, because I won't say any more. But yeah, I think that is, I'm a real champion of just making art for art's sake. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's good art. I'm not trying to make the argument with the book, but in a general sense, that's how I feel about it.
Is there anybody that you write for when you are writing your book? Is there anybody you have in mind, a reader, a friend, a family that filters your writing in any kind of way?
No, actually, it's kind of a very closed off thing. I am very open to feedback. So when working with Weatherglass, it was a case of, you know, working to all these different sections kind of very closely. If they came to me with feedback, I might feel a little bit affronted, but the point is to go away and come back and think, okay, how can I work this into that? And just sort of muddling it through and see what happens. But ultimately, I write just for myself primarily. And that's a question as well, is that, you know, obviously I'm writing from real life experiences. So the places where I worked, the people that I met as well, particularly the older French man, these were people who were just sort of circulating around in my life.
Sorry, so without wanting to get personal, but there was an older French man in your experiences and in your life?
There was, but that was a very short-lived thing which just kind of fizzled out ultimately. No idea what he's doing now, but I think a key point of that as well was investigating what that kind of attraction was all about. And I think that's something, it was the title of the book that I really wanted to amp up and actually deconstruct with the book, was going back to aims, perhaps that was my aim, but actually, yeah, to address that, because that kind of aim to be the French girl is, you know, has an undeniable appeal, which I know a lot of girls and women that I talk to absolutely share that as well. So yeah, I was just kind of writing with myself in mind and exploring those kind of ideas that I've had and experiences that I've had and relating that into something which was ultimately about power as well. But It was all for me.
Power, and yet if I connect it back to what you said was the original inspiration around commuting, is there an element in there of, and you also used the word neoliberal a couple of times, so is there an element of a critique of modern society, of class in Britain? Is that an element that enters the thinking of your writing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the older French man is, I mean, now I know that he genuinely exists, but it could also be a sort of fantasy of the ultimate power, high class kind of guy, contrasted to the more humble beginnings of the narrators. So is that sort of a commentary on that?
Yeah, of course. And I think her, you know, drive to become the French girl is obviously directly, it kind of stems from her wanting for Gustave, the older French man, to notice her. And that's the thing about the French girl trope, is that across media, fashion, she's white, she's probably upper class, slash bohemian. She wears vintage things and she just looks great naturally because she's probably never lifted a finger in her life. And she invests in a skincare regime. And she's very upper class coded. And obviously that is something that she wants and something that she recognizes in Gustave, is that opportunity to have that life. So, you know, she imagines being kind of tied to him, looking around an apartment in Paris, having a baby, being absolutely stunning. So in one sense, she kind of wants to climb those socioeconomic echelons. And that's, which, you know, I think people do in relationships. You kind of, you're attracted to someone because of what they could potentially bring you. Not saying that's me, but as you said, you know, thinking about this kind of where the story originated from, I was interested in the kind of artificial sense of relationships and how class and power tie into those. But yeah, she also seeks that embodied existence. And I think a key thing I want to say is that, or perhaps something I've communicated in some way, was that she, as a woman, it's very difficult to have that kind of embodied agency when you are always at risk or always unsafe. And I think that's the thing she kind of, so when it comes to her sexual encounters, particularly on dating apps, it's very easy for her to, you know, create a situation that she feels in control of and express herself in that respect. And that's a kind of counterpoint to her being ignored at work or being told to make coffee when coffee wasn't needed. As a kind of balancing act to that, she creates these situations of control.
What did you learn from writing this book? What's a key lesson with regard to the next book? What are you going to do differently or the same? Or
I learned to push myself. And again, that's, you know, Weatherglass continuously saying, you need to push this. Where is it going? It needs to go further. And that's made me feel not afraid to do that. And it wasn't my intention to cause visceral reactions in people. Like you said, I have a friend who refuses to continue reading the book because she keeps cringing in a good way. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not something I want to do. I'm not setting out to write thrillers. But as an example, my next book is, which I'm working on at the moment, very different. A, it's in first person, so I'm having to try and describe people's emotions and things, which is really hard, actually.
That is, yeah, that's a bigger challenge for sure.
It's like authors 101. And yeah, just not being afraid to kind of put in these sort of very itchy scenarios, because that's where the kind of the meat of it happens. And that's, you know, kind of getting in those themes and actually making points about it is about kind of setting people up in a difficult situation and getting at those sort of transgressions, I'd say.
100% agree with you. I like that term, itchy scenarios, that you just used. I think that that is one of the prime functions of writing fiction, is to set up these sort of architectures, moral architectures, that are really sticky for the characters and to see how they navigate these situations. So I think that's very well said. What is your next novel about, if I may ask?
Okay, so how much can I reveal? So it's way less heteronormative this time. It's about a female couple. One of them, she's a carer for her mum, who then passes away. So on the one hand, she's, you know, kind of grown up with carer's allowance, living in their benefits and care system. She's kind of struggling what to do with that. But as a kind of offset to that, she's done escorting or sex work. So once her mum becomes worse, then she's not actually able to do that. Once her mum passes away, she has the kind of freedom to go back into sex work. And within that, she kind of becomes involved in this male and female couple who are trying to work out some issues. And she becomes kind of color catcher for all the issues in their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So she becomes a vessel for that. So it's a lot to do with sort of, forms of care, where that sort of comes from, what the effects are on the body and mind as well, I'd say mentally. And class, again, I can't help it. It's about class and power.
If that's what drives your instinctive writing, then, stick with that. Who are your literary influences?
I guess stuff I've picked up over time. Like, I don't really have a backlog of great authors where I went in writing saying I want to be like them. But over time, especially reading Moll's stuff helped to shape How to Be a French Girl, especially. So at the moment, I think these influences might be quite clear in the book. Hallie Butler, she wrote The New Me. And also Julian, I think, as well, just really kind of, neurotic, fed up, young women working temping jobs and kind of describing that really sharply. She's just really funny. Fleur Jaeggi as well, however I'm saying that, Swiss author. I'm just starting to get more into her stuff now, but she wrote Brilla Turca, and it's just really beautiful cut glass stories, exploring some real like kind of dark themes within that as well. And she just does that so precisely.
So it's time for our quick question section. And the first question then is, what's your favorite book that you think I've never heard of?
I would say Siblings by Magnus Florin. Have you heard of it?
I have not. So tell me about that.
There we go. So he's a Swedish author. It's not his only book. I think he's done a couple more. I'm just reading another of his other ones. But it's translated and it's very short. It's at about 90 pages or so. And it's about a pharmacist at a time when their controls on alcohol were lifting in Sweden. And he runs the family pharmacy business and he has all these different siblings and he just tries to kind of maintain control of them. They all go off, trying to sell alcohol or doing other things or sniffing the medicines in the pharmacy. And he goes around trying to kind of rein them back in. It's really funny and really dry as well. And it's kind of fairly similar to Fleur Jaeggi, I'd say, in that it has that kind of sort of telescopic, this happened and this happened and this happened. And I quite like that. I call it sort of building blocks prose, where it's just telling you what happened and then you can figure it out from there. That is, I love that book.
What's the best book that you've read in the last 12 months?
It's the next book by Weatherglass. And I'm not just saying that. I was given a proof copy, but I genuinely love it. They didn't tell me to say anything. It's a translation of a Norwegian novel by Hanna Stoltenberg called Near Distance. Really beautiful, really short. It's a really lovely portrayal of the relationship between a mom and her daughter and where their kind of similarities are, where their sort of conflicts are as well.
What single book would you take to a desert island?
Infinite Jest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Good answer.
Yeah. Just because I am one of those people that hasn't got through the whole thing yet, but I think this isn't the right way to read it at all, but I really enjoy just dipping in and reading a section. Like, it's something my partner and I do sometimes. The last time we did it, it was the passage, I think it's fairly near the beginning, where he's talking about people don't like it when someone's broken into their home because it makes them feel they've had drug addicts in their home or something. It's a really interesting passage. And I think, if I'm sitting on a desert island and I want to remember what the West was like, there's so much to deconstruct from that. And I think there is obviously endless material in that book anyway to get me through desert island life.
Yeah, you'd have a lot to read on a desert
Absolutely.
Island with that book for sure.
Yeah.
And finally, last question, what book changed your mind?
So again, I've gone a bit skew-whiff in my answer, but Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Steingart. So this is an interesting one for me because when the book first came out, there was a massive publicity campaign for it. Like, the posters were on the tube in London. And I bought the book. At the time, I was, I think, a teenager, and I bought the book because it looked cool, as we do. Read it. And then over time, it's kind of one of the only books I've sort of kind of come back to. And over time, my reading of it has changed. So I guess it has been an interesting reflection for me to see where my mind has changed about things, like, how I relate to that character or how the male protagonist, potentially, I hope he's been written as a kind of ignorant misogynist because he comes across that way now. But at the time it's helped me work out a lot of things, I think, just in terms of reading. Yeah, I'd say that one.
Well, Rose Cleary, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me about your great novel, How to Be a French Girl, which I really enjoyed and definitely recommend. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really good talking to you.
And here are some of the books that Rose Cleary mentioned in the interview. Her favorite book that I've never heard of was Siblings by Magnus Florin, published in 2021. It's a Swedish novel about dynamics between siblings. The best book she's read in the last 12 months was Near Distance by Hannah Stoltenberg, who's a Norwegian author. And it's an upcoming book on the relationship between a mother and a daughter. The book that she would take to a desert island was Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, published in 1996. It's a massive novel on a not too distant future dystopia. It's one of my favorite novels of all time. And finally, the book that changed her mind was Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Steingart, published in 2010, which helped her work out a lot of things with regard to perspectives on misogyny. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Lit with Charles. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can always DM me on my Instagram account, @LitWithCharles. I try to reply to all my DMs. If you enjoyed this episode, you should definitely subscribe or follow me, and more importantly, tell your friends and family.